Anyways, so welcome to the show, Tamar, Rachel. It's a pleasure, Tamar. You and I know each other. We went to grad school together. This is so hilarious. We were put in touch by friend of the podcast, Harag Vartanian, who is a wonderful patron of the podcast. He's been one of my biggest boosters. And I asked him, I was like, hey, can you put me in touch with someone you recommend, you know, like, and he's like, oh, he recommended Tamar and Rachel. And I was like, Tamar, would you? I know who that is. I know that name. Why do I have that? So it's so nice, Tamar, you and I have launched. But anyways, like, why don't you two introduce yourselves and you're here in what capacity?
Thanks, Sina. Thanks for having us. It's so nice to reconnect again. So I'm here because, you know, you invited Rachel and I to come on and talk a little bit about what's going on in Armenia, the war in the fall, and this recent recognition by the U.S. government of the Armenian genocide. I'm currently a professor at Michigan State University. I teach in the English department. I teach medieval literature, poetry, and translation studies. And I'm also the editor of the Journal of the Society for Armenian Studies, which has now started a new relationship, a publishing relationship with Brill. And we're taking on some very interesting directions that I think will be coming up today in our conversation. I'm really excited to talk about that. And I'm also excited because Rachel is on board with me and the journal, and her and I work together in conceptualizing the issues, and she's responsible for the what we call the reviews and reconsiderations section. I'll let her tell you a little more about that and herself.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks so much, Sina, for inviting us. And it's really exciting to be here with Tamar because, as Tamar mentioned, we're both working on the Journal for the Society of Armenian Studies. But the thing that's kind of so exciting right now about the journal is that Tamar is the first female editor ever. And she's really been creative in thinking about who to bring on. And I'm someone that really wasn't involved too much with the Society for Armenian Studies. But thanks to her and Bedros Dermatosyan, who's the president of the Society for Armenian Studies and a fellow historian, you know, they kind of encouraged me to get involved. And it's been really exciting to work with her sort of in this new phase of the journal. I'm also a medievalist. I'm a historian, basically of the medieval Middle East. But kind of what my interest is in trying to think about using Armenian histories or thinking about Armenian histories within the larger or broader context of other histories of the region. So I teach at Lafayette College, where I teach, like, you know, basically everything Middle Eastern history, because it's a liberal arts college, like 600 to like now. So
you're a woman of many seasons, of many specialities. So the first thing to sort of bring up is there's been some news. Armenian memory has been in the news. Maybe you could fill us in on the meaning of this recognition that the new Biden administration has sort of initiated. I don't know what it means, but maybe sort of fill in on the meaning of that for people who might not have been following. I mean, I lived in California for a long time, and like, I have to say that, like, before I moved to California, I wasn't super aware of, like, the Armenian question, and not just like the genocide, but like the larger history. Like, but it was, you know, LA is an important, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but like, LA is an important center of Armenian, I guess, diasporic life, Armenian identity, Armenian history. So that's where I learned all this stuff. So, but maybe people aren't really clued in. So
I feel like I'm deferring to Tamar, but if you want me to go first, I can go.
Go, Rachel.
Basically, what's been happening, the most recent development kind of is that, a genocide of Armenian people took place between 1915 and 1923. There's debate among scholars as to whether it started earlier in the 1870s. Most historians across the world concur that it was a genocide. But the U.S. government, although many governments, especially Western governments, have been supportive in commemorating what happened to the Armenians as a genocide and recognizing it as such, the U.S. government has been sort of very slow and hesitant in doing so. And Armenian Americans have been enthusiastically encouraging the U.S. government to, and especially the voice of the President of the United States, to commemorate the Armenian genocide for, at the very least, 55 years. And so on April 24th of this year, President Joe Biden released a statement in which he called what happened to the Armenians a genocide. And so this was a very meaningful moment in many respects, not only for Armenians of the diaspora, but specifically for Armenian Americans, and also especially, obviously, for the Republic of Turkey and for the Republic of Armenia.
And so this recognition, it brought up, I think, a lot for Armenians living in the diaspora, because it was, you know, 106 years since the Armenian genocide. A lot of people have been waiting for this moment, or have been waiting for America. For example, like Sina, you mentioned LA, you know, LA being one of actually arguably the largest Armenian population or diaspora community probably in the world. Maybe that and Moscow, right? So what does this recognition now mean, right? So when you have like your people in a culture that have been waiting for, you know, a century to be kind of validated in this experience, right? When you know that your family and your ancestors have been massacred, you've heard the testimonies, you feel that a trauma, you know, generationally, right? In your body, in your family, you're dealing with it, you're not dealing with it. And now comes this recognition, right? It leaves a lot to think about, both I think individually as Armenians, but also culturally. And so what happens now, right? Like now that it's here, and I think that is something, you know, for me, I think it just doesn't end with the recognition, right? Like it's part of a process. And that's something more that Armenians have to think about. And so it's natural, I think, and it makes sense that it brought up a lot of different reactions, right, in Armenians. Some were disappointed because it was just a statement, right? It wasn't like, for example, a speech. And it's interesting because in the past, on April 24th, you know, the presidents would come up and give a speech, but what would be missing was the actual recognition. And I thought it was really interesting for me when Obama, you know, kind of recognized it, but he used the Armenian word, you know, medreyeren, right? But this time it's like we didn't really have something, you know, like a president actually saying something. It was like this circulated statement, right? And I could imagine that felt really detached for some people. It did for me for a moment, right? Like I was like, okay, it's here, you know, the recognition is here, but like I'm alone reading this thing. Like, you know, I imagined like a celebration in a community or something like that, you know? Yeah, so I think, you know, that it's just interesting to think about what that means right now, especially with what's going on in the world, you know, and the war that we just went through in the fall with Artsakh.
Yeah, and there's still things going on right now, right? Like this is not a settled question by any stretch of the imagination. So that this statement is happening right now can't be separated from that either. So my own, albeit uninformed and like passively informed position at first, I was like, we said this in our pre-interview, which was like who are these people to recognize anything? Like who is it? Like this guy, like Joe Biden, while they were in government, their policies, especially in Syria, like actually resulted in the deaths of Armenians. This is like, I don't like the sort of warmongering that happened in Syria, for instance, like actually like had consequences for actual Armenians. And so there is a cynicism in me, and knowing what this iteration of like Clinton or like the Democratic Party, and it's in this weird moment we live in, what does it mean to institutionalize memory and trauma and do it under the auspices of a kind of national identity history? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but I think Tamara and I both have things we want to say. I think that first of all, and I'll let Tamar, you know, sort of continue her. We were just talking when you were out of the room. But I think one of the things is that one is that Turkey has never recognized the Armenian genocide. And so I think for a lot of Armenians, they see that the U.S. recognition as hope that the United States would place pressure on Turkey. And I think Michael Arlen, in his book, Passage to Ararat, he has a really important section where he says something along the lines of, the thing about the Armenian genocide was not only that Armenians felt like a dog that had been kicked to the side of the road, but then like a dog that had been kicked to the side of the road and whose pain and suffering was completely ignored by the people that had perpetrated it. And I think that's quite different to the Jewish experience. So I'm not even sure we can talk about an institutionalization of Armenian memory. An institutionalization around what?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree too, because if you talk about institutionalizing memory or like an epistemology that thinks about memory, it suggests that there's an acceptance that the memory is somehow true, right? Because in, for example, in the Jewish experience, like there is validation of the experience, and not only by Jews, but also Germans, there is like the, you know, a conversations that are happening, films, media, art, that are trying to process that experience, both, you know, for the Jews and for the Germans themselves, right? The Germans thinking about what is it that we've done? How do we come to terms with this, right? As a culture. So when you have, when you're talking about this in terms of the Armenians, you know, I think it's interesting, for example, that Joe Biden recognized the Armenian genocide, but we don't talk about the genocide of the indigenous people of the Americas, right? So for me, that experience is actually more parallel to the Armenians, because we have to think about the ways in which, first of all, we're seeking constant validation, right? So it's been 106 years. And like Rachel said, the Turks have not recognized the genocide. So what is that? Where does that leave us, right? And I think it brings up all these questions about identity, about truth. And not only has Turkey not recognized the genocide, there is a systematic denialist literature, right? Institutionalizing that denialism, right? Through the study, like through epistemology, right? Through universities, through books and all this stuff. So there's actually like not a movement forward of acceptance and healing, but actually like a counterproductive way in which all that is both affecting Turkey and Armenians, right? Because in a way, Turkey's not, by Turkey not accepting what they've done, they're also not able to heal, right? So for me personally, I think, like, I feel like we're at a place as Armenians where we shouldn't be thinking about that validation from outside of us, right? Because we're living with that trauma. We're living with the, you know, generational stuff that's being passed down. And I think we need to figure out a way to heal ourselves, you know? And I really, like, so recently, you know, I've been, Armenians have been thinking a lot about futurism, and I have been too. And there's a group of Armenians that are starting to work and think about the futurism movements, like particularly indigenous futurism and African futurism, as a way in which you kind of face your past, right? But you try to liberate yourself from that past by imagining a future where you're healed from it, right? And you think about the intersections and ways in which that liberation and the future, you know, just in futurism themselves, like we talk about technology, art. One thing I'm personally interested in is thinking about women and how, like, the study or tracing of women and what they've done, like Armenian women writers particularly, can be a potential futurism that can rewrite the history of the past by looking at the way women have talked about it or thought about it. And the way that they could potentially create like a vision of ourselves as Armenians that can be both sympathetic and understanding to what we've been through, but also not stuck in the trauma, right?
I mean, I just want to say that, I mean, if you don't mind, Sina, I would just like to say that, I mean, I think we also, obviously we have to differentiate between the Ottoman Empire and the Republic of Turkey, but it's very convenient when and if the Republic of Turkey decides to claim the Ottoman Empire as its, you know, parent state, and when it decides to completely, you know, disrupt it or like, or separate itself from it. And the question then becomes, you know, if the Republic of Turkey consistently wants to separate itself from the Ottoman Empire, why doesn't it just recognize the Armenian genocide?
Yeah, I mean, like,
it
it's not
really make
yeah,
sense.
It's so I don't I mean, like, it's not like Turks are unique in, like, this history is unique. I mean, I don't mean to cheapen the Armenian experience, not at all. But I mean, in the sense that, like, there's global history of erasures of indigenous people across the globe.
That's right.
Like, why should we believe that, like, somehow our region was exceptional, was not included in it? And especially given the fact that, like, the current problems we're living in, like, we are living in the after effects of the Ottoman Empire in the sense of Sykes-Picot, the redrawing of the maps, right? Like, and there's another factor with Armenians too, which is, like, there is an Armenia now. There's an independent Armenia, right? But that was under like that, that's in that weird rubric of the post-Soviet republic, right? And like that has its own complications of like being subsumed under the Soviet story for whatever reason and for whatever force of history. And so like it's interesting that, you know, and I know this because of, I mean, Tamar, you, I know you obviously, but like it, to see how Armenian-ness as the umbrella is really like a powerful force. And I realized that like this is a kind of using indigeneity, right? Like using the identity as something to bring you together, because the goal of ethnic cleansing, the goal of genocide is to erase that identity. So the very existence of Armenian studies, right? Like the very existence of like is kind of proof that their project didn't, you know, didn't work. It was a failure in a sense, right? Like the goal of it. I mean, I don't know. I guess there's historical questions of like, what is the goal of a genocide? Is it racial erasure? Is it a like, you know what I mean? Like well, how do we talk about it? Like,
well, if you look to the Republic of Turkey, I mean, as you know, the state within which a gross majority of Armenian literature and architecture was in fact created from, let's say, I mean, if we want to talk about when Armenians become known as Armenians, start writing in Armenian, let's say the 4th century until the 20th century, I mean, the Republic of Turkey has done a remarkable job of erasing that culture and that architecture in the past, you know, whatever it is, almost 100 years, right? So the intention, at least within the Republic of Turkey, seems clearly to be a campaign of cultural erasure and a manipulation and institutionalization of memory in a way that Armenians, of course, Armenian studies exist, but Armenians are not unified, do not have, and the government of the Republic of Armenia and the diaspora are consistently, you know, have different opinions on the ways in which history should be understood. So when we talk about institutionalization of memory surrounding the Armenian genocide, I think the only place we can really look to is the Republic of Turkey. And
which is the last place that gives you, that opens its doors to you. I mean, that's,
yes,
that's right. The conundrum, right? Like the people who need to do it the most refuse to do it. It's yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you. I'm seeing it now. I never really thought of it from this angle. Like, cause I feel like, do the people who like eradicated large swaths of like the famine in Iran,
right?
Like do they ever sit, do they even acknowledge it? Do the Brits do like, and on top of that, like, I studied British literature. I studied the British Empire. Did I ever really encounter any serious accounting of the hundreds of millions of people that, or billions of people who got their lives destroyed, erased, turned upside down, displaced? You know, like there is no, like Turkey in this way is not exceptional. Also in the sense of hiding its past, covering up and like alluding to it. And sometimes I wonder too, if not, I don't think this is a controversial thing to say, but the performance of, you know, in German it's called Vergangenheitsbewältigung, coming to terms with the past, which is kind of like the quasi-official term for the official recognition of Germany, of like National Socialism. Like, I can't help but think of the fact that, you know, there, that like a large portion of that memory that was then, like the memory of the Holocaust was then marshaled into, conveniently, into an apologia for Zionism, right? That like, that they, literally at the, there is like a US Holocaust Museum, and one of their like top sort of policy figures is literally like an imperialist who calls for war in Syria, who's like one of these like neocon ghouls. Her name isn't coming to me, but she literally works at the US, I think Holocaust, like the main Holocaust Studies Institute of the US. That's like the national one. You know, I mean, we know about the Museum of Tolerance in LA, you know, like, and in Jerusalem, like these are not separated from the ongoing sort of settler colonial conquest of Palestine, of historic Palestine, right? And so like you can't help but notice that the sort of politicization, the always already politicization of this memory. And it's interesting that it might even be a blessing to Armenians that Turks refuse, that Turkey, like modern Republic of Turkey, refused to do this. Because I don't know, I feel like, is it a hegemonic thing? It forces you to like keep doing it anyways, like it's a process. Like, I don't know, is that a weird thing to say? Maybe, I don't know. I'm not saying thank Turkey for this, obviously. But I mean, in the sense that like, there is a kind of moral victory in having them deny it so much. And like, I'm sure people are gonna come after this episode. I don't care, come after it, fuck off, I don't care. Like, whatever, like I have nothing to afraid of. Anyways, that was not even a question that time.
Well, I think also one thing I will say, like having spent a lot of time in Turkey and working, you know, primarily, I guess, being trained primarily as an Ottomanist, I will say, and having traveled in Turkey quite a bit to various like sites of Armenian, like destroyed Armenian monuments, there really is a large, I mean, Turkey is a very diverse place, right? And so I think part of the problem in the context of the history is that Ottoman history and Turkish history has had a tendency almost to be extremely classist and focused on specifically on cities. And that when you look at, I mean, when you look at like approaching Ottoman history, right, which is like, you know, considered sort of fundamental to the field, it's a book by Soraya Faroki that tells us where to look for sources on Ottoman history. And basically, there's a tacit agreement that Ottoman history is history that's written in Ottoman Turkish, right? Whereas we know that Ottoman history, I mean, just by looking at a map and just by thinking about what an empire is, obviously the history of the Ottoman Empire is more than those documents produced in Ottoman Turkish. The empire was multilingual. People were living in villages. I mean, you know, there are many different ways to look at history from the ground up in the Ottoman Empire. By and large, the history, although it's gone through some changes and there are many scholars who are trying to look at history from different vantage points, I think that this kind of classist or top-down approach to Ottoman history and to Turkish history is really problematic because, for example, when you travel into Central and Eastern Anatolia and you go and visit Armenian sites, the people in those villages and cities live with Armenian buildings. They know that they are Armenian. So although the official discourse is an erasure of the Armenian past, an imagined history that where Armenians didn't exist except uniquely during a specific moment where they were quote-unquote traitors, and then they, you know, there was a war and they were displaced, you know, I was traveling once in and around Ani, and, you know, these Kurdish villagers in this town called Argo or Adich, which hosts like an 11th century Armenian monastery to which one of the most important gospels, the Hakpat Gospels, were brought in the 13th century. That place was completely destroyed, most likely by bombs. Like most of the Armenian architectural heritage in the East was destroyed intentionally by bombs and used as target practice in the 1960s. The Kurdish children there, when I got to the site with a bunch of other academics, and you guys will appreciate this, classic academics going around with like their maps and books and trying to find places. And I had early on realized on this trip that kids play in these places. They become their playgrounds, right? So I found these three kids and I was like, hey guys, can you show me where the cool stuff is? And they were like, of course, of course. And they start running me around and they're like showing me all the inscriptions. And I'm like, you guys, it's over here. You know, you guys, they're showing me this stuff. And then they took me to this cross, these three kids. They live in the mountains. So they have that leathery skin. They look like they're 20, even though they're 11. And so,
yeah,
yeah, I know what you're talking about. You know what I
mean? And one of them points at this cross and he says, "Abla, bu senin mi?" Which means like, big sister, is this yours? So obviously these kids are 10, 11, and 12. They're Kurds. They live in this village. This is their playground. And still they understand that it's Armenian. Do you know what I mean? Like they knew that I was Armenian. I was there to look at that site. So, you know, we have to think about the diversity of experiences with Armenian stuff in Turkey and that the government's, you know, attempt to consistently deny Armenian passes has not really been successful.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Sina, you talk about memory and like, you know, memory, institutional memory, I mean, arguably is history, the study of history, right?
Yeah.
Which is a memory, right? But futurism is also a form of memory. You know, there's this wonderful poet called C.A. Conrad, and I just went to a reading of theirs, and they told this story about how their parents were factory workers, right? And to be a factory worker, you can't live in the present because then you will have to accept, right, that you are part of the machine, right? That you are actually in the darkness during the day working as part of a machine. So you live in the past or the future, right? And that's exactly what happens to traumatized people, both individually and culturally, right? Memory is a memory of a past or a memory of a future, right? And you know, think about memory of space, you know, like Rachel was talking about cities. You know, it's really interesting that a lot of Armenians are connected to cities, right, as spaces. But if we think about the memory of cities or the memory of places, you know, like the diaspora has a very different romanticized memory of, for example, Armenia, right? Many of them, their ancestors never lived in the Republic, right?
Yeah.
They're coming from, you know, the Ottoman Empire. And then they were told this is like a homeland, right? A space of memory. The actual space that their grandparents, like my grandparents are from, doesn't exist in that way anymore, right? Yeah. And so now you're like given through literature and the study of literature and texts, right? Like for me as a child, I had this conceptualization or idea of what my homeland or Armenia was going to be like, right? No one else told me that but books, you know? It's like I work on the Crusades and it's like all these like European crusaders that talk about Jerusalem, they've never been there. Right. But they write these huge historiographies that are like imagining the Holy Land and they've never seen it. They've never been on pilgrimage. Right. And that kind of historical memory, you know, bringing up the Crusades and like what I work on is really this idea of colonialism. It's a colonial memory. Right. It's like France trying to assert its colonial power on an empire or the imagination of a future empire or a past empire. Right. That are connected. By saying, like, by writing histories that erase other cultures, like the Greeks, Armenians, the Jews, whoever lived there, right? The Arab world, the Turks, the Persians. So when we think about the writing or history or memory, right? And you think about imagined spaces, that's also kind of a form of thinking about a potential future space, right? That a person could occupy. So I bring this up to think about how we can use memory. So memory could destroy, but memory could also help us rebuild kind of ideas of a potentially healed future, right? So I know
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And their refusal to acknowledge that history makes the impulse, like, you know, it makes the impulse to remember, to commemorate, to like, to think of and to consider, it makes it that much stronger.
That's
because
right.
Because it gives you an inspiration. It says, okay, you want to forget my pain? I'm going to remind it even louder. I'm going to tell more people about it. You know, and I think there's, you know, I mean, it's not lost on you the fact that, like, there are literally like something like 1,100 Holocaust museums in the U.S.
Right.
And look at the state of Israel-Palestine. Look at the fascist goons, like, enforcing Zionism, which I'm not saying totally, right? Which I'm not saying I'm not a guy who says, like, Holocaust industry, stuff like that. Like, I mean, yeah, like, anything can be industrialized, including historical memories of genocide. Anything can be turned into like a cheesy museum experience if the will is there. But the very reality that Zionists have done a disservice to their own past, like, you can't help but see these pictures of Zionist settlers sicking dogs on defenseless Palestinians, and you're like, gee, what does this remind me of? Right? Like, that's a threat. That is a threat to all that you've built up about your own past. Like, people won't be able to look at you know, that the history of, and I think, and I don't mean this, I think I really believe that this is true. I think that in a while, and I think this was really the result of Zionist own actions, they fused the ethnostate of Israel to the memory of the Holocaust. They did it at first to justify it, right? We can never have this again. We have to protect ourselves. We have to show that we won't be weak again. We have to have a big military. We have to like pound anyone who resists us and our will, right?
But that's a development in Zionism. I mean, if you read Theodor Herzl's original text on Zionism, it was complete. His vision was completely different.
Yes. 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 Right. Zionists took the memory, right? Yeah.
I mean, he envisioned a multi-religious, multi-linguistic, multi-ethnic utopia, basically.
Right.
Or like, yeah, but a utopian ethnostate but this is also the curse of, I guess in some ways, like blessing in some ways, is that this is, that Armenians share too, is that there are Armenians in Iran, there are Armenians in Arab countries, there are Armenians in Turkey. Like, this is the nation state history doesn't map on to the identity of Armenianness so cleanly, right? Like, I'm Iranian. I was born in Iran. My parents were born in Iran. You know, I mean, I could be like a pan-Iranist and be like, Azerbaijan is ours, but I'm not going to be that guy. But like, it's fairly easy for me to do that. Like, the nation state history that overlaid the world in the 19th and 20th centuries, it translates pretty easily. You know, Persianness, blah, 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 who cares? Fine. But like, Armenianness is a little trickier because like there are, you know, I mean, they're not huge, but there are vibrant Iranian communities vibrant Armenian communities throughout the world, right? It's not, and And unlike Zionists, I don't think the actual country of Armenia has, or maybe correct me if I'm wrong, like, what is the state of, like, the Armenian nation state to Armenianness? Is it, because as you said, it's like a lot of the homeland isn't there, right? Like, is it like kind of after the fact Armenianness? Is this like a placeholder for Armenianness that the realities of the nation state just have to resolve? Like, I don't know. Like, how do you guys feel about the country of Armenia?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions. There's, I mean, let me, as like,
or, you know, how does the country of Armenia feel about us?
I think, well, one thing is, like, Armenians are, you know, an indigenous population to what is considered today sort of the Armenian highlands that are in eastern Turkey, right? To the Araradian plain. But Armenians have been a people in dispersion since at least the 12th century, right? So although that was the homeland, there have been Armenian communities throughout Europe, the Black Sea. Obviously, there's been an Armenian community in Jerusalem since at least the 5th century. So, you know, Armenians have been a people in dispersion for quite some time and have been living under foreign governments for, I would say, at this point, a majority of, you know, at least a majority of the modern history. The last Armenian state collapsed in 1375 prior to the establishment of the Republic of Armenia in 1918. So I would say, I don't know, from a historical perspective, I would say that oftentimes Armenians are uneasy in some ways, at least Armenians who have been used to living under other states, uneasy about the idea of an Armenian state. And there were, I mean, throughout the 1950s, there were lots of what we call Haydenatarts, or individuals who moved from the diaspora to the Republic of Armenia under the USSR. The relationship between the diaspora and the Republic of Armenia is quite complicated. There are, you know, Armenia, as you mentioned, that Armenians oftentimes have a tendency to try to map on to sort of Jewish experience. Armenians also created a Birthright Armenia program.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Oh God, I gotta go, guys. I gotta go jump off. I gotta go jump off a bridge. I mean, it's not as bad. I'm gonna say that it's not as bad. It's just corny. It sounds bad. Oh, birthright.
Yeah,
that's not right.
But yeah, birthright is not right.
That's not the right word.
But I mean, I think that one of the issues, and this, to get back to this question about genocide recognition, one of the issues regarding genocide recognition and U.S. recognition of the Armenian genocide has been a clear discomfort among some individuals who live in the Republic of Armenia, who have recognized the potential danger that could be associated with Armenia, the Republic of Armenia's geopolitics, if and when the United States should commemorate and recognize the Armenian genocide. And, you know, to be frank, to talk about the diversity of sort of responses, even within my own family, my brother Harry lives in Chicago, and he's, you know, he's very much an Armenian American in the sense that he's like, it's good that our government is starting to recognize wrongs in the world. Now we need to move on to, you know, justice for Native American peoples and Black Lives Matter. Like, that's his approach. I, you know, as a historian, I had a very complex response to thinking about what this recognition might mean. And my brother, who lives in Armenia and has lived there for 10 years, was like, I really hope they don't recognize the Armenian genocide. Do you think the U.S. is going to support us if and when Turkey and Azerbaijan attack Armenia again? I mean, and that seems to have been a common thought in the Republic of Armenia. I don't know. Tamar, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you actually really laid that out pretty well. And just because I'm in literature and I think art and literature could heal everything, you know, I'm going to bring the conversation back. I don't know. I think it's interesting to think about, for example, like African writers like, you know, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Ami Cesar, who thought about language actually also as an interesting way of connecting. So I think, you know, your question about Armenianness is really complicated. And, you know, Sina, you're pointing out an interesting thing where kind of nationalism has placed people within like these boundaries of a nation, right? To say like, I'm Iranian, I grew up in this area, you know, my parents come from there. But I mean, I wonder if Armenianness sometimes, and I've written about this, excuse me one second.
Uh-oh, they found us, guys.
Can you hear that?
They found us.
okay, here we go.
It's fine. We keep this all in. This is all going in the podcast.
You know, I've thought about, like, you know, having moved to Michigan, right? Where, you know, I don't really have, there is a strong Armenian community in Dearborn, but I'm not that close there. But thinking about, like, well, what is Armenianness now? Like, how does it change from when I lived in LA, right? Where I really felt like a strong Armenian community. I was immersed in that, you know. Like, my last poetry book is around this, but what does it mean here? And I found myself kind of thinking about language a lot, right? And then, you know, I compose in Western Armenian too. So I've thought a lot about how language might maybe create ways in which this Armenianness could exist. So I don't know if it's about, like, you know, how Rachel was talking about Armenians being, you know, pretty much a diaspora culture, you know, from a very, very, like, early time, right? Since we've been around, like, thousands of years ago. I don't know. I think it would be interesting to think about, and I don't know the answer to this, but, you know, what would it mean to, like, decolonize that experience, right?
Yeah.
Or out of empireize, you know, I don't know, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Take it out of, like, an empire and these kind of Western frameworks that think about the idea of time, history, the study of people, places, you know, that always want to orient them in a kind of, like, national frameworks, you know? And what does it mean if we, like, thought of, like, a bloodless genealogy of, like, cultural interaction, right?
Yeah.
Like, a genealogy of language, you know, a genealogy of experience. Like, I think that creates really interesting connections between people that could also allow for types of healing, right? Like, I know in my work, I write in Western Armenian, right? And Western Armenian is on the UNESCO list of endangered languages. And I'm very much influenced by African writers that think about what does it mean to write in the colonial language, right? Mm. Versus what does it mean to write in your own native tongue? And then the questions of, like, who's going to read that literature? Is it important just to write in it because it survives? How does that connect to your sense of identity, Armenianness, mm-hmm. space, you know? And I think, like, it's way more complicated than just boundaries and borders and, you know, because so much of Armenians have been intertwined in the politics and history of so many different parts of the world, you know?
Which is a strength, right? Like, that's,
yeah, exactly.
That diversity, yeah, is the strength of the identities, that, oh, we don't have to rely on this little ethnic category called Armenianness. There's some who speak Persian. There's some who speak Arabic. There's some, you know what I mean? Like, that is that's a strength that a kind of ethno-nationalist, Kemalist, I don't know, is it called, like, maybe revanchisme? Like, is it a kind of revanchisme that represents? Because Erdogan brought it back, right? Like, that's what he is. He's like, I want to get back what we lost, right? Like, that's the desire. But that makes you make mistakes. Whereas if you're open to a diversity of communities, like, you then take the best of all these different cultures and you make them something. And that's an advantage that I think Armenians have over the people who want to erase them from history.
Yeah. I think also one of the interesting things about Erdogan is that it gives us an opportunity to reconsider the Ottoman Empire as an empire, as a colonizer. It gives us an opportunity,
right,
in many ways. You know, I was just reading this really good article on indigenous populations. It was written primarily from the perspective of the Assyrian experience in Iraq. And talking about how in this article, it's in the AHR, it was on the, let's see, it's by Sargon George Donabed and Daniel Joseph Tal.
Oh yeah. Sargon Donabed has a big book on this. Yeah. He's very critical of Edward Said, interestingly. But anyways, that's something else.
Yeah. I haven't read it, but that sounds very interesting. But in this article, they talk about the problem with thinking about indigeneity in the Middle East stems from a Eurocentric or West-centric idea of what indigeneity means, and that,
right,
people like Assyrians and Armenians are not considered indigenous by the governments that rule over them or by the empires that colonize them from the beginning. And it also brings me back, when you started talking about literature, I started thinking about Katib Yassin, who's one of my favorite authors. Yeah. You know,
right,
he's a Francophone author from Algeria. And towards, yes, the end of his career, when he was exiled in Paris, he refused to write in Arabic. I mean, he never really wrote in Arabic, although he spoke Arabic, but he refused even, he said the Arabs colonized us and then the French did. And yes. He started writing theatrical pieces in French that then he would have to have translated into Berber, and intentionally, yes. You know, had Berber plays performed in Paris to show that he had been doubly colonized, right? Yes. And yes. So this question about how we think about empire and colonization as uniquely associated with European powers is probably part of what has made Armenians, Assyrians, Kurds, has made it difficult for them to claim indigenous status.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
So, I mean, I guess in some ways, I mean, and this is an impossible question, but like, Armenian identity is strong. I mean, that's a dumb way of putting it, but I mean that, like, it's not going anywhere. Like, Armenians are not, like, I mean, I guess maybe this is my own influx of being in LA, is that you see Armenian. It's not erased. It is vibrant, but, like, I wonder what happens with the next, I don't know, the next 50 years of our planet and our cultural history and the rise of global English and God knows what China's sort of cultural ascendancy will mean. Like fewer and fewer, like there are languages that are dying and smaller languages do suffer from this. Like Europeans are having this problem too, right? Like, and so I wonder, like, how do you, I guess, is this the job of the diaspora as much as it is people inside the country, nation state of Armenia? Like the idea of Armenianness is something, is the torch, and we need to sort of keep it going in any way possible. Like what, how do you, I mean, and obviously there are real conflicts and they go on, but I mean, for the future steps, like what do you two personally do? Is it just you do this work, you keep these archives open, you invite more people, you try to get people to study? Because, you know, there is that also problem of the diaspora problem, and this is something that I guess Jews and Zionists know themselves, which is relying upon hyphenated peoples, so like Jewish Americans, Jewish Canadians, whatever, Armenian Americans, like relying upon them is that you have to deal with the problem of assimilation. Like people forget and people just assimilate and they don't care, right? Like they become, you know, there is that force. So I guess in some ways, is your job, like you two personally, like is this a kind of, not guardian, I want to say like, but are you a kind of proponents of this culture in a very neutral way?
I mean, first I want to just say one thing, and I'm sure Tamara and I both have lots of ideas about this, but one thing I want to say is, Sina, I think that I disagree with you that Armenianness is not under threat. And I think that
it's very
interesting that Tamar and I, although you brought up the war several times, neither one of us have wanted to comment on it. I think because it was an extremely traumatic moment for every Armenian that I know, because it felt like an existential threat. And yeah. I mean, I have a brother who lives in Armenia. I can justify it in every way I want, that I have the right to be upset. But ultimately, what was traumatizing about it was that it felt like a completely existential threat to Armenians. Yes. And many of us were stuck in huge depressions, not sleeping for months, concerned about this war in a place that maybe we visited once or twice. Do you know what I mean? And
so this
speaks to maybe some problems with Armenian nationalist identity. But then we come up against the problem of this question of indigeneity, attempted destruction of one's culture. And what is one supposed to feel in a moment like that? And, you know, the truth is that diasporic communities, I mean, you know, the institutions that have supported them seem to me weaker than ever and more reliant upon cliches like support Christian Armenia, which, you know, just turns off pretty much any thinking individual. So, you know, it feels like a little bit of, yeah, as you said, can we be neutral proponents of a culture? Is it possible to be such a thing?
Yeah. And So in your question, let's just trace one thing. Let's say, I proposed this earlier, but it's really complicated. But let's say we said Armenianness is language, right? Well, let's think this out for a second. Armenian has many dialects, two major ones, Eastern and Western, right? The Republic of Armenia changed the orthography of the language, right? to what they claim to be an easier writing system that doesn't share the same orthography with Western Armenian, who is now endangered, right?
People in the Republic
do not speak Western Armenian. There are some classes taught in universities, but the actual language and literature is the new orthography and Eastern Armenian, right? Now, in the diaspora, the language is dying. For example, this morning, I had a conversation with my son about this podcast, and he was asking me what we were going to talk about. And I explained to him, so I think about a genealogy of language, right? So he's the last in line in my family to know Western Armenian. And my kids do tutoring online, right? They're actually technically enrolled in the Armenian school in Dallas, Texas. They work with a friend of mine, but he will be the last in my family to speak Western Armenian, right? So language itself, even if we take it as a marker of identity or Armenianness, is in threat, right? And if we take a traditionalist point of view that Armenianness means speaking Armenian, reading, writing Armenian, that's already diminishing, right? So the idea particularly of a diaspora community and a diaspora Armenianness is indeed, I agree with Rachel, in threat in those ways, right? And then, you know, you have globalization. And like I was saying earlier, like a lot of people tell me, like, why do you write and publish in Western Armenian? And this is, you know, I'm actually going to, there's an issue coming out in PMLA, and I'm thinking about actually taking up this challenge and really working through this question. Like, you know, the way Nguge Wa Thiong'o thought about it, right? And like, what does it mean really to be a poet in Western Armenian, where most people in the world don't read you and where Armenians don't read you, mm-hmm. right? Maybe a few people read your book, right? Like, what is that? What does it mean? Like, and does it just mean that you write it because it's staying alive that way? You know what I mean? Which one's more important, you know? And so these are things that, like, as an Armenian, like, I struggle with. And then as an Armenian writer, I think about. And then I go to the Republic and people see me on the street and they're like, you wrote that crazy experimental Armenian work and you're just ruining the Armenian language.
You can't win.
Like, poetry has to rhyme. Like, how could you make flowers with your poetry and work on visual poetry with Armenian, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, you have people that have gone through that movement and their literatures have gone through that movement. They're like, that's really cool. Yeah, you're really thinking about deconstructing the language and sound and, you know, like how word and letter are images and, you know, things like that. So you get the validation elsewhere, not always from Armenians. It's really complicated, you know? Mm-hmm.
Adding to that, I mean, like one of the things that in some ways I've struggled with in terms of the Armenian community appreciating or not appreciating my work is that, you know, I studied under an Ottomanist, under Cemal Kafadar, and from the earliest days that I was studying, like Vahakan Dadrian, who's like one of the most, you know, famous historians of the Armenian genocide, would say to me, like, why aren't you studying the genocide? You have to study the genocide. Right. And I have found it to be of particular importance to study earlier Armenian history to show that Armenians actually existed there before they were killed there. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, while there is a lot of literature on medieval Armenian history that's composed in the Republic of Armenia, there is also an epistemological problem with studying medieval Anatolia or early Ottoman Anatolia or just the early Ottoman world in that Armenian historians or Armenologists oftentimes are, you know, just writing for one another. And there are so few historians that know Persian or Turkish and also know Armenian. So then it furthers the gap kind of between the literatures or the histories that are being written by Armenians and those that are being written by historians working primarily in Western languages or in Turkish, such that they seem almost like two totally different histories. So, I mean, some of the work that I do, although it seems so far away from anything related to the Armenian genocide or the attempted erasure of Armenian culture, so much of what I do is try to reconcile sort of the historiographies that are composed in Persian, Turkish, Arabic, and Armenian about this time period such that we can see that space as a real place of cultural interaction, of the interaction between different kinds of people living in the same area. And that to me, sometimes I wonder, am I doing it out of my own interest? Am I doing it to understand a past? Or am I doing it to change the ways in which people conceive of the past? And I have a lot of questions sometimes about, you know, whether this is an act of love for Armenian-ness or whether this is truly where my historical interests lie.
Yeah, I mean, Rachel's modest, but her work is amazing. And, you know, like, I'm also not in an Armenian department. You know, I'm actually in an English department. And Sina, I was with you in Comp Lit, right? And so, like Rachel, like, that's the way I think about Armenian-ness too, like as an interconnection with different cultures. So, you know, my last book was on Lamentations, and it put in the center, not a, like a particular ethno-religious culture, but the process or the ritual of lamenting the loss of a city, right? And it took that as the center and thought about how both Europeans, the Arab, Islamo-Arab world, right? The Arabo-Islamic world, the Armenians, the Greeks, all kind of came to understanding grief and mourning, right? And the process of lamenting or the loss of a city in similar ways, right? And in that understanding and in the way we share grief, right? That's the way that we connect as people, right? And that was kind of the argument of my book. And it's interesting that, you know, as a you know, granddaughter of survivors of the genocide, I wrote a book about loss and the loss of cities, right? Particularly because I personally can't claim a homeland, right? So I think like in those ways, I think Rachel and I, our work is a little bit different and unique from what we would call Armenian studies, right? Yeah. And you know, I could speak for myself, but I think Rachel would agree that we think, like, I believe this is the way to think about studying the past, which thinks about Armenians before the genocide, right? And that has a culture and a history, a very, like, very strong, rich, and interesting culture, intercultural history,
yes,
and that existed before, and then that we're not stuck in 1915, and we could use this past, right, this rich past, to think about a potential future that's healed from that trauma, right?
Rachel Tamar, I've kept you for almost an hour. Thank you very much for your time. This has been, I've learned a lot. I need to do more. I need to learn more. I think we all do. I think that, you know, we're watching what's happening in Palestine, and we can't sort of close our eyes to aggressions and stuff like that against Armenian sovereignty. And, you know, it's just right in front of us. Like, you know, and I think that, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I will say that I've been very, and I'm sure, I mean, I don't want to speak for Tamar, but I think we share, like, we've been, both of us have been very happy to see so many Armenians both supporting Palestinians and also involved in Black Lives Matter. And, you know, you mentioned Harag at the beginning, and he posted, I thought, a really interesting tweet yesterday in which he said that all of these movements, it's so important to have these global movements and to have them front and center and online because we can all learn from each other. So the solidarity is there and we can all learn from each other. And as you said, it's in our faces and we need to keep supporting the underdogs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Tamar, Rachel, where do we find your work? What are you working on? How do we locate it? Tell us.
I still have to put up a website, but
welcome to 1999.
Yeah, yeah, you know, a lot of the things that Rachel and I have talked about, you know, to shamelessly plug the journal, you know, a lot of the directions and thinking about Armenian studies and Armenianness are coming out in the journal, you know, of the Society for Armenian Studies. This particular volume coming up is on performance and thinking about performance. And, you know, has entries from theater, film, you know, and performance studies. And then in the fall, we have an issue devoted to indigeneity. Mm-hmm. And thinking about indigeneity. And then in a year we have a volume devoted to Armeno-futurism and Armenian futurism. So, you know, her and I are thinking about these ways of changing the field, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of encouraging, you know, scholars to make these kind of connections the way that we do in our work, you know, mm-hmm. and also to think about an Armenian history and Armenianness that is not purely kind of focused on genocide and genocide studies, right? Like as Rachel was saying, so much, because we're so stuck in our trauma, right? Because we haven't healed, everything is about the genocide, right? And so we're trying to step back and say, you know, there's other things that we could think about. There's other ways we could think about Armenianness and Armenian studies and the future of Armenia and Armenians. And the other thing is, you know, like I suggested earlier, we really like want to think about the role of women in this cultural history, right? And in the history, which has been so often forgotten because of patriarchal frames, right? That have both kind of dictated academia, but also like, you know, cultures that have been traumatized and smaller cultures and things like that. So I don't know if Rachel wants to add anything, but, you know, these are kind of ways that we're thinking through a lot of the questions and the discussions that we had today.
Yeah. And I think it's really important what Tamar said. I mean, and, you know, Tamar's work also is, you know, really incredible. And she's so prolific. I'm always like just shocked by how much she does. But you can look at the Journal for the Society of Armenian Studies there. And it's very important now that it's being published through Brill, because it also means that it's available online. So some of these really exciting conversations people can actually read online. And Sina, we were hoping eventually also to come back on maybe with some of our authors and talk with you about some of these exciting topics in the future. That was
absolutely. You have an open. Offer. You guys have an open invite.
Yeah, it would be really amazing to have, like, if you're open, to have each issue have like a podcast with some of the writers in there.
Why not? Yeah. Why
so not? It could be like
every journal should do this. Yeah. Every journal should do this from now on.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tamar. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Tina. Really informative. Thank you, Rachel. This was actually a great conversation. Really, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Here, I'm gonna press hang up. Oh, okay. Oh no, I can press stop. Woohoo! Woo, that was fun.